What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar, but you can call me Cool Hand.
Nobody can eat 50 eggs.
You just said he could eat anything.
You ever eat 50 eggs?
Nobody ever eat 50 eggs.
Hey, Babalugas, we got a bet here.
My boss says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Sometimes the best leaders are the ones who break the rules, not enforce them, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a character more charming and fascinating than Paul Newman's Luke Jackson.
Nevertheless, that is this week's Film Spotting Top 5 Challenge. We'll count down our favorite charismatic movie leaders and discuss The Master, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
All that and more ahead on Film Spotting.
Film Spotting is presented by the new Squarespace. There's no credit card required to try it out. Simply go to squarespace.com/film and start your trial. Make sure to use the offer code FILM9 when you purchase for a 10% discount.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Coming up later in the show, we'll share our top five charismatic leaders. We're also going to get to some of your feedback on our recent Sacred Cow discussion of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
But first, a character in The Master tells us that good science, by definition, allows for more than one opinion. Otherwise, you merely have the will of one man, which is the basis of a cult. Will Adam and I be good scientists, or force the other to submit to our steely will as we review Paul Thomas Anderson's latest?
There will be people on the outside who will not understand the condition you men have. Now, upon your shoulders rests the responsibility of a post-war world.
You can smile.
You can start a business, filling station, grocery, or hardware store. Get a few acres of land and raise some chickens.
You have a break coming?
10 minutes.
If the average civilian had been through the same stresses that you have been through, undoubtedly, they too would have developed the same nervous condition.
You must understand. You want to get the lady back.
How did I get down here?
You're acting aggressive because you drank too much alcohol.
What do you do?
I am a writer, a doctor, a nuclear physicist, a theoretical philosopher. But above all, I am a man, just like you.
With five feature films to consider, including Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love, I think we can safely examine some of writer-director Paul Thomas Anderson's primary preoccupations, or perhaps obsessions is the more appropriate term. Anderson is undoubtedly an American filmmaker, a chronicler of this country's culture, past and present. And scattered throughout his work are the types of characters common to a lot of American literature and art. Con men, and if not crooks, men driven by a corrupting capitalistic fervor, or feeble men simply chasing their piece of the American dream. There's also the prevalence of father-son conflict. Prodigal sons, both biological and otherwise, abound. From Sidney and John in Heart 8 to Jack and Dirk in Boogie Nights, Frank and Earl in Magnolia, the plain views of There Will Be Blood, and now The Master, about a disillusioned, disturbed World War II vet, Joaquin Phoenix's Freddie Quell, who is taken in to be nurtured and needled by Philip Seymour Hoffman's L. Ron Hubbard-like founder of a Scientology-like religion known as The Cause. Josh, it's time for your processing. Despite the expansiveness of Anderson's canvas, particularly with his last two films, There Will Be Blood and now The Master, it seems to me that he's still exploring the more intimate domestic drama of two men struggling to express and accept their love for each other. Do you think my thesis holds water, which only seems appropriate to ask since there is a lot of water in The Master? And if so, were you buying what Anderson was selling?
Well, if I'm being processed, does this mean we have to stare at each other and
you
I'm not allowed
blink.
To blink until...
You cannot blink.
It's going to be fun. Yeah, he's touching on some of those things. Obsessions, that's probably the right word. There are familiar themes and motifs here. I would add characters who are consumed by rage, mm-hmm. characters who are consumed by sexual dysfunction.
Oh, we'll get to that.
Yeah, we see a lot of familiar things. Let's start very simply, and it connects all the way back to his first film for me, Heart 8. He's also fascinated by faces, by close-ups mm-hmm. and the contours of faces. And Philip Baker Hall is the subject of Heart 8, specifically his countenance. Joaquin Phoenix's face, that's what this movie is about, at least to me. It is so fascinating how much time is spent on what is a really unique face. It always has been, but it seems to me, since we last saw him, it's even more withered and worn. He has the cleft lip, and it's almost as if that has somehow grown across his face.
Mm-hmm.
There's elements of it in his chin, across his forehead. And it's more than just a physical look. I mean, he uses this and also the stooped hunch way he walks about to really capture the character. And this is a truly disturbing character. I mean, you wanted to get away from this guy pretty soon on, didn't you?
Yeah, he is. He is a character that I think is hard to feel a whole lot of sympathy for. There's no doubt about it. And you're right that his face is a major part of this film. Close-ups in general and faces in general are a major part of this film. It's not just Joaquin Phoenix. I actually did take a few notes when I watched The Master. As you know, I'm not typically a note taker, but I thought maybe this was a movie that would warrant me trying to remember a few things that occurred to me. And the first two notes I wrote down were half face and faces. My third one was water phallic. We'll get to that in a little bit here, I'm sure, in this discussion. But from that first time we see him, the first shot of the film is the water, which we come back to multiple times. Mm-hmm. But then we come to Joaquin Phoenix's face, and he's actually obscured. It looks as if he's on some kind of transport boat, and he's in the military, and you only see the upper half of his face, about the
great
nose
shot.
Up. And right away, it suggests that he's a fractured soul, that he is someone who is unformed, that he is someone who needs to be finished. And then when you actually do see him, not just his face, his entire body, the way Joaquin Phoenix carries himself, he's like an arthritic fist that is just crumpled and stiff, and every part of his self is in pain as you watch him in this film. And I'm not sure if the line is actually in the finished film, but it's in the trailer we played, where there's the scene, maybe my favorite scene in the movie, actually, where he's in some kind of institution, clearly, as the war has ended, and they're about to get out, and you just have a voice, a disembodied voice, telling them that the burden of post-war America kind of hangs on them.
Yeah, that's in the film.
And they have to go out. I know there's the part about how they can go out and become farmers, or they can run a filling station or whatever, but I couldn't remember that line, and then I was reminded of it in the trailer. But you really get the sense, watching Freddie Quell, that he is bearing the post-war burden of America on his shoulders completely.
For sure. And I think it separates itself from the father-son dynamic you're talking about, although that's here to a degree with the Dodd character, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I think the focus really is more on Freddie than on their relationship. This is a movie about his spiritual journey. You mentioned unformed, and it's a deeply disturbed, broken guy trying to repair himself. And he doesn't even know if he's capable of it, but he sees in the Dodd character and in this movement maybe a way that he can do it. And so the question then is, if this is a false movement, if it isn't really offering something, what happens when Freddie comes to that realization? And so we see this tragedy building. And I think it speaks to something even larger, actually, the more I thought about it. And again, where it breaks away maybe from what Anderson has been doing in his other films, Scientology is the jumping off point here for sure. But as we follow Freddie's journey, it came to me to speak about this idea of faith in general, that if you're looking for something sure or to be answered in any sort of religion, whether it's Scientology or something more traditional, there's going to be a point where you've got to put faith into it. You're not going to have that surety. And it seems to me that Freddie comes to that breaking point in this movie where that's the key question for him. And so it became a character portrait, a really intimate character portrait for me, maybe similar to Heart 8 in how it focuses on the Philip Baker Hall character more than anyone else. But this seemed maybe the most laser-like focused character portrait Anderson has done.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're discussing Paul Thomas Anderson's new film, The Master. I really want to get into this notion of faith and dive into some of the details and larger themes of this film, but I'm curious if you'll indulge me just a little bit in a more arbitrary exercise and just sort of assess your experience watching the film, because I have to confess, I fully expected The Master to be a movie that would challenge me, it would impress me cinematically, as Paul Thomas Anderson always does, and it would likely consume my thoughts for at least the first 24 or 48 hours after seeing it. And Paul Thomas Anderson delivered on all three counts here, but I did also hope that it would really grab hold of me, that it would be one of those transcendent movie experiences like There Will Be Blood was for me, frankly, like The Tree of Life was last year for me. I had those expectations going in. Maybe that was a little bit unfair, but I didn't have quite that sublime movie-going experience that I was hoping for. Maybe it's due to how episodic the movie is, how small, when you really break it down, how small the narrative arc is with both main characters, Freddie and Dodd, but the best way I can describe it is I had sort of an out-of-body experience watching this film, and maybe that's appropriate, but I became aware of the fact that I was having mostly an intellectual experience with The Master and not really at all an emotional one. Certainly, though, I was challenged and I was impressed and consumed enough by it that I really want to tackle this movie again. And maybe that will change on subsequent viewings, but it was something I was longing for that I didn't get.
It doesn't have that Anderson juice that maybe we've come to expect and are looking for, but I tend to think that's a good thing. We associate that with the films of his that are these prodigious hat tips to the greats of the cinema. So you can think about Heartache being Scorsese in miniature. Boogie Nights and Magnolia I would put together as his ensemble Altmanades.
With a lot of Scorsese in there too,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, of course. And There Will Be Blood. It's really nothing less than Citizen Kane in the oil business. So there's another film here that's standing apart, and you know it's my favorite of Anderson's, Punch Drunk Love. I would say that that and this film are his most idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the ones that only he could make. There is no clear through line to another director or another particular film. And so part of the trouble might be that we don't have those immediate jolts of cinephile connection.
Maybe not.
That he has given us in some of his films. I tend to be, I don't know if suspicious is the right word, but even while I'm on board with all those jolts and I like them, I find them to be a little bit less interesting than when he starts noodling around in his own direction. And I feel like the master, like Punch Drunk Love, operates in that way.
I think it's interesting, though, that your focus, really, your big takeaway from the film is on how the movie explores the notion of faith. You mentioned a spiritual journey that he's on, because I got to be honest, faith is not one of the first 10 words that would come immediately to mind for me with this film. Obviously, I understand that you can have faith in things beyond a higher power, but there's really no talk here in the cause of any kind of supernatural deities. Beyond that, this isn't even a movie that's tracking the birth and evolution of Scientology, which I think maybe a lot of us thought it might be going in, or how even L. Ron Hubbard, this figure, achieved his status. And it's not even, for me, Josh, really about whether Freddie has any faith in the cause. I'm not sure he ever does. I don't think he has any faith in it to ever lose. I think the only thing that Dodd is offering that Freddie seems to want is his love. I can't help but keep coming back to that drama. Whether PTA is suggesting any kind of homoeroticism or not, I think we could discuss that. But this film, for me, is ultimately about their tragic relationship, how they want so desperately to connect but can't. It's also, more than anything, I think, a movie about sex, but we'll get to that here in a minute as well. For me, though, it really does come down to that. I don't think, if you watch this film, you can really argue that Freddie ever buys into anything that they're doing. He buys into it because he knows that it gets him closer to Dodd. And that's what he wants.
You don't need him to buy into it for it to be about faith. What it's about is the struggle
of faith.
His faith
is in the person.
And the fragility of faith.
His faith isn't in really the cause. It's in the person who's spearheading
the cause. Well, I saw it as him finding something that might allow him to improve himself, to make his life about something beyond himself.
I don't think he really wants to make himself better. I think he thinks that he might be healed by being close to this man.
That central sequence in the house of Laura Dern's character, who's this adherent to the cause, and she opens up her house for a retreat sort of training session. There's an extended sequence of Freddie committing to it, going through much more than the processing that he does at the beginning. Compare those scenes in the house with the processing scenes. The processing scenes, he's screwing around, even though he passes the test. Mm-hmm. He goes through all the motions, but it's a much different Freddie in those early processing scenes than it is in the house when it's this rigorous test that he has to go through. And there's a reason he does that, because he understands his own misery, and he understands how he doesn't fit in this world because he's broken and he doesn't know how to interact in it. And so that's why he's pursuing this larger cause that will help him improve himself. And that tension is what held me through the film. This isn't a film about a guy who has faith in something and becomes better. It's about a guy who keeps going back and forth, so that even later, when one of the cause's adherents suggests a little skepticism, he beats the crap out of him.
Right.
Because he wants
because
it to
it's
be
a
true.
Challenge. No, because it's a challenge to the master. I think that's the only reason why.
I didn't read it that
it's
way.
It's a challenge to the person he reveres, the person that he wants to love. And I think that the man that you're describing in that scene where we see Freddie going back and forth in this crucible, there's a reason he's doing it, and that reason is maybe a little bit to punish himself. There's a little bit of a martyr character, someone who, like a Jake LaMotta, maybe doesn't see himself as worthy. But I think more than anything, he does it simply to please the master. That's why he's doing that. I don't think he believes that by going through these motions, he's actually going to come out the other side a better person or a healed person at all. So I think, obviously, a little bit of a disagreement on how we see that larger theme. But I am curious about your take on the film in relation to what it may be saying, or at least exploring, when it comes to sex. Because we've talked about some of these larger themes that go throughout P.T. Anderson's work, the prodigal sons and the salesmanship aspect to it. But it was only watching The Master that I realized just how preoccupied he is with two things, one being sex and the power dynamics of sex. It made me go back and reexamine Sydney or Heart 8, Clementine, the Gwyneth Paltrow character. Think about her job as a prostitute on the side and her plan with John C. Reilly to make a few extra bucks. How Sydney himself is a character who is very successful, maybe because he also seems asexual. Obviously, Boogie Nights fits into this, but maybe most germane to this discussion of The Master would be the scenes where we see Little Bill, the William H. Macy character, explode with that kind of rage over the fact that his wife is cheating on him. And also later in the film, when Mark Wahlberg gets the beatdown when he's prostituting himself. Magnolia, the misogyny of Frank T.J. Mackey's character, Julianne Moore's confession there in that movie. Punch Drunk Love, the trouble Adam Sandler gets into when he calls the porn hotline very memorably and reaches Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then There Will Be Blood, a movie that was criticized because it didn't have any women in it, but maybe that's why sex looms over everything in that film, because it's completely absent from the story. So when you talk about Paul Thomas Anderson and you talk about sex and this idea maybe of impotent male rage, Freddie Quell in this movie is figuratively and perhaps literally an impotent man. He is, from the moment we meet him, obsessed with sex, and that never changes to the final frame of the movie. And I think we can actually make a case that we never see him fully consummate a sex act. He has chances. He doesn't follow through. He has a sure thing early in the film when he goes out on a date. He falls asleep at the restaurant. The relationship he has with Doris, the 16-year-old girl he met previously, that dominates a lot of this film or a lot of his memory, there's an innocence to that that's kind of questionable. You never see them go further than a peck on the cheek. Think about as well, Josh, the implication of the I'll Never Go No More a roving sequence where Philip Seymour Hoffman is performing and we see the entire room full of women, and at one point we see them completely naked. It's not completely clear whose point of view that is, but it seems that it would be Freddie's point of view.
Yeah, I took it to be Freddie's.
And so there's some really interesting things going on there. Also, Amy Adams, who plays Lancaster Dodd's wife, is in the scene, and we see from her this real interesting use of sexual force with her husband to control his actions. And I'm going to dance around it a little bit, but the dialogue in this scene is key as you compare it back to Freddie and what I was saying about his impotence, because that sex act, you can believe, is completed as ordered. So this movie overall has, it struck me, a strange Lovian obsession with precious bodily fluids and fluids of all kind. Again and again, it comes up, and I don't think it's by accident that at one point there's a sequence where Freddie and Dodd have a blow-up. They have their first big fight, and they're side-by-side in cells. And finally, Dodd just can't take it anymore, and he relinquishes his responsibility over Freddie. And immediately as he says, I don't want anything more to do with you, what does he do? He turns, and he takes a leak right there with him watching. I'm serious. There is something Paul Thomas Anderson is very clearly trying to suggest by exploring sex in this way, by even exploring fluids in this way. I'm not quite sure I can articulate it, but whether it's a comment on our dependency on other people, our animalistic tendencies, which comes
right,
up over and over
animalistic.
Again. I don't know.
Let's stop at animalistic.
Maybe even just our puritanical hang-up in this culture on sex. It's abundant in this film.
None of those instances you described, was it any sort of depiction of sex as something beautiful, something
no.
that brings about human connection, something that is rewarding in any way?
Right.
It's all animalistic. And at some point, Dodd even describes Freddy as an animal. I think on more than one occasion,
more than once,
he
yeah.
describes him as an animal. So I'm going to bring this back to what I see as this idea of Freddy becoming one sort of lower man to become a better man. I mean, it ties in with the Scientology thing, too. That is considered a self-improvement religion. It's
right.
based on self-improvement. But some degree of becoming a better person is inherent in all religions. So I think it does tie into that other theme. And again, I see the focus on sex very early on. We first meet Freddie humping a sandcastle in the shape of a woman, and he keeps humping it as his fellow seamen in the Navy walk away and stop laughing. They realize it's getting awkward. He keeps going at it.
Yes.
From that point on, sex is an example of Freddie's brokenness.
Absolutely.
And how he can't
process
anything.
We're not disagreeing on that.
Well, I'm just reacting to why you think it's such an obsession in the film is because it reflects that. And that is one other thing that he sees in himself as something that's not right. It's something that needs to change.
I think he acknowledges that.
The people who are dancing naked, that's clearly from his perspective. And you'll notice that the Amy Adams character is across the room and she makes eye contact with him or the camera. And it's this look of just confusion and disgust as if he catches her looking at him. And even though the people aren't really naked, that's what he's thinking, mm-hmm. she somehow knows what's going on in his mind. And it's this concept of shame.
Or maybe she's sharing the fantasy.
I took it completely as that's what's going on in his mind. And it's the shame factor that's coming in that he knows he could be better than this.
What's this time all business?
It means going back to a place and realizing you're on the wrong track. And getting ready to start life over from the ground floor. So that you can get out of your home.
To allow, to give over, to accept that when you are in processing, what comes to you is always right. Always right. Always good. Always helpful. Will always lead you toward the pain.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We are exploring a lot of aspects of the new film, The Master. Very interesting work from Paul Thomas Anderson. And yeah, I think we could spend a lot of time just focusing on that one sequence because I agree with you. But at the same time, it's notable that the sequence I described that happens with Amy Adams and Philip Seymour Hoffman's character with husband and wife right after that would suggest that maybe she was reacting to something in Philip Seymour Hoffman's actions, in her husband's actions, that suggested that he knew he was in a lot of ways seducing the room. And that really is what he seems to be up to as a character, maybe more than anything else.
Yeah, we should talk about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He is someone who seems like maybe the self-gratification is really what he's after, more than anything, more than changing people's lives. But I think the only place we're disagreeing, Josh, is yes, he recognizes that he's broken, but I just don't see him at any point believing that the cause itself is what is going to lead him to any kind of salvation.
Would you agree
I never see his character. I agree he's on a search, but I think he thinks he's found the answer in this man. And so I think it's more about this humanist connection between them, and he doesn't want to let that man down. I don't think it ever has anything to do with, if I follow these steps, I'll buy into it. I never see him start to really change. I never see him start to become healed in any way. So I think it's more about their connection. It's not that you have to see it happen.
It's about the inner turmoil that he's going through that. Mm-hmm. But let's get back to Hoffman because I think it's a really interesting performance, and it's going to be interesting to see how people talk about these two in comparison because I think Phoenix's is really rich and clearly the heart of the film, but I have a feeling Philip Seymour Hoffman is going to get a lot of the attention because this is a character who just dominates every scene he's in, and rightly so.
It's so much
less showy than Joaquin Phoenix, though.
So,
really?
Oh, yeah, it's so much less showy. He is so much more still in every shot. He's gregarious, sure, but he is so restrained.
I would say
Joaquin Phoenix is doing that mannered walk and the mannered style of talking. Everything he does is mannered in this film. It's very methody. It suggests that he's made some bold decisions. I don't think that those bold choices come through as much with Philip Seymour Hoffman. That doesn't mean it's any lesser of a performance. In fact, it might be a better performance.
Hoffman has these huge speeches where everyone's watching him. He even sings. He even dances.
Yeah,
it's
but that's different. That's different than
Phoenix.
Than how he behaves even in one-to-one conversations. You can always tell the Joaquin Phoenix's character seems to be struggling. That fits with his character,
right?
But he's working at it. He is working in every frame. Philip Seymour Hoffman seems much more loose with it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think they're both good performances is the point. And what I really like is the way Paul Thomas Anderson gives Hoffman that license to kind of take over some of those scenes. The first one where we meet him is on a ship, and Phoenix comes in, is kind of standing awkwardly in the doorway. Mm-hmm. He's been brought to Dodd. He was a stowaway on the ship. He's been brought to him like, we found this guy. Dodd is just sitting at a desk. And in the shots of Phoenix, you can see that Dodd's, the corner of his red shirt is in the lower left-hand corner of the frame, kind of intruding on the frame, intruding on Phoenix's presence. And it's just clear right there that he's going to take over this guy's mind, or at least try, and it's going to be a battle of some
sort. Maybe so. No, that's interesting in that framing. And it's not something I even noticed until I was watching the trailer online today. When I saw it in the theater, it didn't strike me, but I did notice the red intruding on the frame there. It's an interesting choice. I think, too, as we talk about their performances, and I think Amy Adams is very good in this movie as well, I love what Paul Thomas Anderson does in terms of the framing and how he sets up some of these tableau shots. I think that what you see in the way characters are photographed a lot in this film is this notion of perfection that he keeps talking about, that the cause seems to be intent on returning people to this perfect state that apparently at one point they embodied. They are trying to attain some ideal. And so, as I said, there's a stillness to Philip Seymour Hoffman and to Amy Adams, but especially in that scene. Think about when Joaquin Phoenix shows up in the doorway and he comes in. We never actually get an establishing shot of the room. We don't get a full body shot of Philip Seymour Hoffman. The whole frame is just basically a medium shot from his waist up, and he's tilted. He's cocked at kind of an interesting angle, and his head's at an interesting angle, and he just turns and looks and talks, and he's very still, but the whole thing seems to resemble one of the shots we saw earlier in the film, one of the many shots we saw earlier in the film, where Joaquin Phoenix, coming back from the war, goes to work at a department store as a photographer. And I think that this gets back to this notion of the American dream, which for me is, along with sex, what this movie is really about. Because what you have in those scenes, what I think you see reflected in this culture of that time, coming out of the war, a little bit of an economic boom, and you have families going to the store and getting their shot that they're going to hand out on their cards, or they're going to show to all their neighbors, and they're going to frame on the wall. And it doesn't matter how crazy things are really inside that house, what kind of awful dramas might be going on and how flawed everyone is. That picture on the wall is going to suggest a sort of perfection. It's going to suggest that, no, things are really good, and you're going to get that perfect smile and that perfect head tilt. And we actually see that reflected in just about every shot that we see Philip Seymour Hoffman.
And they play that out a little bit when there's the confrontation with the one client Phoenix has as a photographer. I like
right.
how that's extended there. All right, let me give one more try, one more shot at this faith thing for you and how this is about the frustration of faith, because I think it becomes a bigger, better film than just a replay of things Anderson has done before in earlier films, if you look at it this way. It's not only Freddy's journey, but this idea of being frustrated by faith and depending on it and not seeing it pay off also hits the Laura Dern character mm-hmm. that I mentioned when she comes across in Dodd's second book something that doesn't quite fit with something he claimed in the first book, and she confronts him about it and he kind of brushes her off. Her whole world kind of crumbles
yeah,
at that point.
Yeah, but she's truly an apostle, and he never
exactly.
really is. He's a thug.
Exactly. But this is what I'm saying. It's about other people's faith journeys and
that's
how that's a struggle as well. And even Dodd has it when he is challenged during a house party and someone comes in and brings up the cult word and is very skeptical about what he's up to. And it's where Dodd loses his cool. One of the mm-hmm. very few times where he loses his cool, because his own faith in what he's selling is being undermined there.
Right.
So I really think I just want to stress that, because I don't want The Master to be thought of as a smaller, minor Anderson film that rehashes some of his previous
things.
Well,
I'm certainly not suggesting that.
Okay, good. Because
there's no way I'm suggesting that.
Good. Because we're still close to it, but I'm putting it up there along with one of his better films at this point.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think the fact is, I can watch a filmmaker replay, if you want to use that term, the same themes and examine some of the same fears or myths or whatever you want to call it over and over again. I think the best filmmakers and the best artists often do that, especially when it's as rich and as nuanced and as varied as you get from film to film. We can paint all the connections we want between this film and There Will Be Blood or Hard Eight, but it's a completely different movie on so many different levels. I do think, though, what comes through here, which he's been exploring in all those films, what comes through maybe most pressing, most urgently in this movie, is this exploration of the American dream, though. More than faith, it's a huge part of it. Religion and spirituality is a major part of any life journey. But I think what you really see here is him exploring this concept of the self-made man. And that is crucial to any exploration of the American dream and that myth, this notion that you can be truly independent, that you can be reliant on nobody, and you can achieve whatever success you want on your terms. You see that throughout every one of his films, people struggling with that notion, people who either are self-made men, like Daniel Plainview, like Sidney in Hard Eight, but they've sacrificed some part of their life, or you have people like John C. Reilly, like Barry in Punch Drunk Love, like the son in There Will Be Blood, who are fighting against that and still trying to retain some part of their humanity while also being a success. So that struggle is something that happens over and over again. I think that the final confrontation in The Master, I don't want to spoil it, but the final conversation that these two main characters have gets to the heart of this. And it harkens right back to the final conversation between father and son, and There Will Be Blood as well. There's just this notion, I think, that even the master is aware of. There's no doubt he's aware of it, which is even he is beholden to someone. He ultimately is making the final decisions and calling the shots, but Amy Adams exerts a lot of control. His wife exerts a lot of control over him in this film. And so there's always this idea of, can you really go out into the world and be wholly self-sufficient? Can you really achieve all those things that people like that man who stand in front of those soldiers and say, you can have it all. Just go out and live the dream, buy whatever you want, find happiness. Can you really do that? I think that's what he's really interested in here.
I did like the placement of Amy Adams in that final confrontation scene, and won't get into it in any more detail, but just how Anderson frames that and stages that.
It's a really nice little trick there in that scene. I agree. Well, we could probably go on about The Master, but we'll stop there for now.
I think we already have gone on about The Master.
We will stop for now. I'm sure it will come up in future shows. The Master is out this weekend in a fairly wide release, I believe around 800 screens. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and Facebook.com/FilmSpotting. If you'd like to leave a voicemail, we'll take those too, 206-203-2463.
You can tell Michael Phillips to take the stick out of his posterior. Massacre Theater and your pleasant and not so pleasant Raiders of the Lost Ark feedback are next. Stay with us.
You might put your love and trust on the line. It's risky. People love to tear that down. Let them try. Do it anyway. Risk it anyway. And if you're paralyzed by a voice in your head, it's the standing still that should be scaring you instead. Go on and do it anyway. Do it anyway. There'll be times you might leave before you look. There'll be times you'll like the cover, and that's precisely why you'll love the book. Do it anyway. Said I'd never do. Tell me what I said I'd never say. Read me off a list of the things I used to not like, but now I think are okay. Sometimes it's not subjective, wrong and right.
We're very pleased to have Squarespace, the new Squarespace, back on board as a sponsor of Film Spotting. And we know we have a lot of creative listeners out there, filmmakers, graphic designers, other artists, probably looking for a great service like Squarespace to showcase your work. Maybe you already have a website, but it's just not working out the way you'd like. You think you can do something better, more professional. We think Squarespace may be the answer. They have a completely new design and new templates to showcase your films, videos, and reviews in a gallery, collage, or slideshow. It's very easy to use. It's all drag and drop. It's very structured, and everything's integrated. You get design, domains, hosting, and support. 24/7, around-the-clock Squarespace support that responds in minutes to any problem you have. They also have live online workshops to walk you step-by-step through everything you need to know to build an amazing site. They also import and integrate social media, so you can take your content right from your current blog and easily set up sharing and syncing with your social media account. So a lot available to you to really spice up your site using the new Squarespace.
Go to squarespace.com/film. Squarespace is $10 a month for the standard plan and $20 a month for the unlimited plan. If you sign up for a year, you automatically get 20% off. And if you sign up for 2 years, you get 25% off. Don't forget to use the offer code FILM9 to get an additional 10% off during checkout.
It's done. You did it. Despite your grand attempts, the chips are set to fall. And all the stories you might weave cannot negotiate them all. Do it anyway. Be honest anyway. So tell me what I said I'd never do.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's Marty McFly in Back to the Future, one of my all-time favorite 80s movies. And with Looper opening up next week, Rian Johnson's new time travel movie, we're going to try to gauge your thoughts on what the best all-time favorite time travel movie is. But right now, it's time for Massacre Theater, where we perform a scene from a famous screenplay and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Now, for you something to drink, a wine, a cocktail, Espresso?
No, I'm fine, thank you.
I'll make it myself right back there with a little lemon twist. It's good. Try it.
No, I'm fine.
I see you look at this piece.
Yeah, I was wondering how much something like this went for.
$130,000.
Get the f*** out of here!
No, I cannot. It's serious because it's very important piece.
Have you ever sold one of these?
Sell it yesterday to a collector.
Get the f*** out of here!
I'm serious, I said it myself.
That's Eddie Murphy as Axel Foley and Bronson Pinchot as Serge from 1984's Beverly Hills Cop, directed by Martin Brest, who I noticed looking at his IMDb page, Josh, had a pretty good run in the 80s. Three movies in a row, Beverly Hills Cop, Midnight Run,
oh, yeah,
and Scent of a Woman. Unfortunately, he followed that trio with Meet Joe Black and Geely.
Oh, that's right.
Both not very good films. So unfortunately, he flamed out there a little bit.
The tie-ins came from both our main review of End of Watch, which was a cop movie, and of course the top five list of L.A. movies.
If you'd like to hear that top five and our discussion of End of Watch, you can get it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Your performance, Josh, as Serge, was one for the ages, I think we'll put it that way. And I want to share this email, one of my favorite emails ever in response to Massacre Theater, from Rob Cosgrove in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think I finally put my finger on the kind of courage that Josh summons before doing a scene, and it's what makes his work, work in quotation marks, so memorable. It's the courage of a stroke victim who, before totally recovering, has attempted to run a marathon. And having reached that 26-mile, completely dehydrated and having lost his sense of equilibrium, manages to finish standing up as if the opposite poles of his collapsing body had somehow held each other
up. That's cruel.
The only thing that confused me was the great 80s sitcom actor he seemed to be channeling. It wasn't Bronson Pinchot, a.k.a. Balky from Perfect Strangers. I think it was actually Charlotte Ray, a.k.a. Mrs. Garrett from The Facts of Life. But that's just Josh being Josh, making choices. Choices that don't just push the envelope, but seem completely oblivious that there's an envelope at all. I love, love, love the show. It never fails to brighten my day.
Well, I've long said, wow, if a performance doesn't have a little Mrs. Garrett in it, it's not really a performance.
My favorite part, re-listening, and I actually caught the show Saturday night on the radio, and I was listening to it after our appearance on the Late Live show.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite part by far, Josh, is the line where he says, it's a very important piece, which in your interpretation came out, it's a high, high.
I was a little worried I had left English behind.
Totally
at some
unintelligible.
Point there. Yes, I know.
Get the F out of here.
No, I cannot. It's serious because it's a high important piece.
Have you ever sold one of these? Now, of course, listeners can be very kind. They can also be cruel. And this shows how fickle they are, too, in responding to some of our performances here.
Yeah, George Sinfield from New York, New York wrote, you'd think that Josh's Bronson Pinchot impersonation would have been the giveaway, but the more nuanced Eddie Murphy that Adam delivered was what ultimately led me to Beverly Hills Cop. Thanks for an entertaining take on another 80s classic. Apparently,
it was all me.
Apparently you had the magic touch.
I somehow channeled Eddie Murphy, even though there's no chance I did that. But there's disagreement on that.
Jake Meltzer from Brooklyn, New York wrote, Beverly Hills Cop. It took me a while to work through Adam's lifeless Eddie Murphy interpretation.
Ouch.
And Josh, perhaps, set back Eastern European relations 20 years. But I was nevertheless tremendously entertained.
That's always the goal.
We try.
We hope you were tremendously entertained, even at the expense of our dignity. There
clearly
were a lot of entries.
Clearly.
There were a lot of entries. So I'd say it paid off, Josh. It was nice after a few weeks where entries were down a little bit low. They were back up. The film spotting hat is brimming.
Good.
Please reach into the hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Chris Jones from Annapolis, Maryland.
Congratulations, Chris. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we'll set you up with your prize.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
Tragically, it's time now for a non-accented edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
I'm not really sure there's anything we need to say about this scene. I think everyone's going to probably get the tie-in overall to this week's show, talking about
so.
The Master, our top five charismatic leaders. So with that, I started off. You're going to give me the action.
It's kind of emotional for you. Are you ready?
No, I'm never ready. I don't make bold choices like you.
And action.
I killed the ship. They killed us. Not very Christian of me.
You did what's right.
Coming from you, that means almost nothing. I'm long gone.
Doc will bring you around. I look to be bored by many more sermons for you, Slip. Don't move.
You can't order me around, boy. I'm not one of your crew.
Yes, you are.
And
scene.
If you know what film, thank you. We just massacred email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. I know there are a lot of film spotting listeners that love this movie, so I want to see some entries this week. Your deadline is Tuesday, October 2nd.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hey, come with me.
This isn't our stop.
No, come on, let's take a walk.
We don't get off here.
I know, we'll just be spontaneous.
You're kind of freaking me out.
I know this is going to sound really weird, but I have a really bad feeling about this train, and I think that we should get off, okay? Just get your stuff.
That's the Duncan Jones film Source Code, starring Jake Gyllenhaal, and it's going to round out a time travel theme to this week's poll results and poll question. Last week, as we discussed End of Watch, the new L.A. cop drama starring Gyllenhaal and Michael Pena, we posed to you a death match. We were wondering which of the Gyllenhaal siblings you think is the better actor. Simple death match, Jake and Maggie. Those are your only two choices. Josh, how did it come out?
You and I voted for Jake. Jake won 57% to Maggie's 43%.
Surprise you at all? Did you think it'd be closer? Or Maggie might win?
No. I thought Jake would come away with it once people looked at his filmography as we did. Because, again, I was kind of surprised to see he's been in a ton of really good films.
He has. Unfortunately, as some people noted on Twitter, he's also been in The Prince of Persia.
Yeah, I mean,
he's done some junk.
Right, exactly. And maybe that worked against him. Could have been.
Thank you to everyone who voted in that death match. It started off so close, though. It was really like 50-50
almost. Oh, was it?
And then as the week went on, people came to their senses. Yes, and voted for Jake Gyllenhaal. Thank you again to everyone who voted. We hope you go to filmspotting.net and vote in this week's poll as well. Rian Johnson's new film Looper is coming out. Stars Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It is a time travel themed film. So we're asking you what your favorite time travel movie is, but you cannot include Back to the Future. I know that if we included that, Josh, it would just run away with it, as it probably should.
Certainly should.
So the question is, what's the best non-Back to the Future time travel movie?
12 Monkeys, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Donnie Darko, Groundhog Day, The Terminator. We also have Terminator 2, Judgment Day. Or the category of other, we put films like Primer, Deja Vu in there.
Yeah, I think both of those movies will get a lot of love, but maybe not enough, or maybe they're not mainstream enough, popular enough to make them their own options in this poll. So we are giving you the option of other. And as I was trying to come up with these choices today, I had initially cheated a little bit and put The Terminator and Terminator 2 together just so I wouldn't take up the space. And then
it's like The Godfather all
over
again.
Yeah, it's like
again.
The Godfather. And I realized that if I was voting and it was The Terminator with The Terminator 2, I would have gone with those films. But separating them, it might force me to actually go other. I finally did catch up with Tony Scott's film Deja Vu, and I think it's pretty fantastic.
You're going with Deja Vu out of this list?
I may.
That's ridiculous.
No, there's some good movies there, but I'm also not a fan of 12 Monkeys at all, and I know a lot of people love it. So how would you vote?
Well, Donnie Darko and Terminator 2 Judgment Day I was really thinking about, but then it occurred to me that time travel is a plot instigator in those films in a lot of ways, but it isn't a continual part of them as much as something like Groundhog Day. So that's where I'd end up.
Okay, well, I'm curious what our listeners are going to say. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. We did want to take a moment to thank everybody who came out to support us and enjoy some great comedy at the Late Live Show this past Saturday night. We were guests with Joe Quazzala, the host, and this is the second time I've been on. Josh, your first time. I know you were a little bit nervous.
I was until I saw that the size of the theater was about the size of a kitchenette.
It's very intimate.
Yes, it made me feel a little
better.
It's
a smaller space, which is more fun than an expansive space, so it was one that we felt very comfortable, very at home with, and it was our first appearance together, I think, on a forum like that. And I don't know, the feedback I got was that it went pretty well. We got some laughs.
Yeah, I thought it was fun. And I think it helped that they were doing some very funny things there too. So they had really good material and that helped get everyone in the right mood.
Yeah, and they have two more shows left this season. So if you want to check out The Late Live Show, you can learn more at thelateliveshow.com. For us, not only was it fun to be on that show, but we got to hang out with some film spotting listeners. We had a meetup before the show and after. It was nice to see Angela, Kamaria, JJ, Sarah, our producer, Golden Joe Dassault was there. Josh, our wives, participated. And our associate producer all the way from Texas/Australia/around the world, Candace Griffith. She was there as well. She came all the way to Chicago just to see that appearance.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, amazing. but that's how staunchly she supports film spotting. So thank you, Candace, and everyone else who came out. Also wanted to plug our bonus content for our film spotting app users. If you have the Android app or our iPhone app, we're going to get into a little bit more listener feedback, go back to your thoughts on our top five dance movies, some more films, Josh, we overlooked. Some
These
more great choices.
They keep coming in,
They keep coming in. Also, some responses to our top five films of 1981 with some strong thoughts on which Superman is superior, Superman 1 or Superman 2. You can learn more about our apps at filmspotting.net or just do a search in iTunes or Amazon's Android Market.
Jones, do you realize what the Ark is? It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God. And it's within my reach.
You want to talk to God? Let's go see him together. I've got nothing better to do.
Harrison Ford as the great Indiana Jones from Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark, a film we discussed a few weeks ago here on Film Spotting, our third Sacred Cow discussion. This is a movie that was just recently re-released in theaters. We saw that as a good opportunity for us to see it for the first time in a long time. Josh, I don't know what it had been for you, but that's a movie that I hadn't seen since I was probably 10 or 11 years old.
Yeah, I saw it probably a couple years ago.
Did
so
you?
Not quite as long.
I had not revisited that movie at all. Saw it with fresh eyes. Had a really fun discussion with you and Michael Phillips, our regular guest from the Chicago Tribune. Unfortunately, Michael, not so firmly in the masterpiece camp that we were in. He was actually decidedly not in the masterpiece camp. He thinks it's one of Spielberg's lesser films, had it ranked
doesn't
outside
even like
his
it.
Top 10.
The man doesn't even like the movie.
And yet, we still like Michael Phillips, and we'll still allow him to come back here on the show. We wanted to get into some of your feedback, because we got a lot of it in response to Raiders of the Lost Ark, and it was kind of fun to see how varied the responses were. I mean, almost all of it is critical of Michael, as
yeah,
well
pretty
it should
much.
Be. But you saw different people who saw it as kids, some people who came to it later in their lives or have revisited it over the years and had different reactions to it, have had their feelings about the movie evolve over time. And let's start with this one from Kathy in Alfred, New York.
I love your recent foray into Sacred Cows. It's great to hear you dissect the movies we all know and mostly love. I saw Raiders at the sweetest of sweet spots for that movie, age 13. Adam, take Holden in 3 more years, she says. It's one of my top 5 movies of all time, and the first movie after which I left the theater a changed person. Yes, I'm one of the people who would legally marry Raiders if I could.
Yeah, that was Michael. That's how he referred to people who loved this movie.
It was particularly cruel to hear Michael Phillips dismiss Raiders so cavalierly. The last time I was so disillusioned by someone I knew I could count on was when Elliot Spitzer got caught with client number 9. Oh well, live and learn. Our heroes have flaws, just like we do. What's next on your list of sacred cows? Spinal Tap? Sunset Boulevard? Raising Arizona? Ooh, I like that last one. Whatever you choose, bring it on. I love this new film spotting initiative.
Okay, so choosing Kathy's email was a little bit self-serving. It allows us to promote a future Sacred Cow. We do already have it planned, and we're planning to talk about another Steven Spielberg film.
Yeah.
It just worked out that way, that we really want to talk about Close Encounters of the Third Kind, celebrating a 35th anniversary in November. Another movie I only saw as a very young kid. I'm really excited to see how I respond to it now as, unfortunately, a much older man.
It's been quite a while for me, too, so that should be interesting looking back at it.
And we will have Michael Phillips, I'm pretty sure, back on for that show. That whole show right now is shaping up to be a Spielberg extravaganza. We're also going to talk about Lincoln, his new film that's coming out, and do our top 5 Spielberg scenes.
I would love that.
If you want to already start sending in your suggestions, I look forward to those. Peter from Essex, England, wrote in, said, I thought I'd just weigh in and shield Michael against what I imagine will be an avalanche of pro-indie backlash. Straight away, I should say that I didn't see any of the Indiana Jones films until I was in my 20s, but my girlfriend absolutely loves them, so I gave them a go and went into them already as an adult. Like Michael, they leave me a bit cold. The duality of Jones being an archaeology professor by day and a swashbuckling hero by night / weekend doesn't work for me. I get that he's meant to be a kind of geek hero, but I've never really liked Ford as Jones or Han Solo.
How can we even bother to read this, honestly?
I mean, Peter, you just have to turn in your film spotting card. You have to turn it in right now. Raiders has its moments. Peter goes on. The gun part is funny and was a lucky accident, as didn't Ford have a dodgy stomach that day and wanted to just get the shooting over? In Spielberg's canon, Jaws is also the main standout for me. That was Michael's argument. A timeless classic. I'd even go as far to say that Temple of Doom is a bad film. Last Crusade is entertaining, but not much more. So you are not alone, Michael.
All right, instead of piling on here, I'll try to say something nice. Temple of Doom is a bad film. We didn't talk about it that much when Michael pointed that out, but it's really one of Spielberg's disasters in my book.
Disaster.
Yeah, along with The Lost World, which is interesting because it's, you know, a sequel to a huge hit, and mm-hmm. both, oh, just really bad movies.
Well, let's move on to a longtime listener of the show, always sends us great feedback, usually long feedback. We've abridged this slightly. Jeff Houston in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Regarding Raiders, count me in the masterpiece camp. Adam, you talk about viewing it inevitably through rose-colored glasses, but I think Raiders clearly rises above nostalgic viewing alone. There are plenty of 80s classics that do require some rose-colored lenses to still appreciate today. You love them, but also realize apologies and exceptions must be extended. Raiders rises above that. It needs no apologies, exceptions, or qualifications. Like all timeless masterpieces, it still stands on its own merits, out of time, and for all time. Adam, I'll even take issue with your one caveat about the finale. Ultimately, this is God's battle, not Indy's. So not only is it not a cop-out to put Indy on the sideline, but it's done almost out of necessity, or at least reverence. If something someone is to take out the Nazis, it deserves to be the Almighty in all the glory of his Old Testament wrath, especially when the Ark is the iconic instrument of that glory and wrath. Besides, what else would you expect from a Jewish director?
A valid point. And other listeners wrote in defending the finale of the film. We were both a little bit critical of that. I think Michael was too, actually. And I get a lot of what they're arguing. Certainly, I saw it within this larger context of Indiana Jones does go on a little bit of a faith quest in this film. He comes face to face with a spirituality that he has otherwise completely
rejected.
He's
skeptical at the start.
He's skeptical
right.
early in the film. That is a small part of the film, and I can't help but think, though, even with the arguments made against what we said, I can't help but think that there was still a way Spielberg could have probably tied it up a little better, where we could have actually seen our hero doing something active at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Instead, he's just tied up, and that's not really all that compelling. So I'm still leaning that way, Josh, but again, some really good arguments made in favor of the ending of the film. Jesse Lowborough, hopefully I'm somewhere close with that, from Bath, United Kingdom, says, I have to start by saying that Raiders is my favorite movie, and I was so pleased that you chose to revisit it in one of your shows. While I could go on at length about why I disagree with Michael's comments about the film, I will instead mention something you didn't discuss in any particular detail, and Jesse singles out the scene where Harrison Ford gets flustered when he's in front of the class, and we see the girl with Love You on her eyelids, and Jesse argues that this very human imperfection in one form or another crops up again and again during the movie. Unlike most action heroes of the 80s, Indiana Jones can't do it all by himself. He's human. He's terrified of snakes. He's outmatched physically by the bald Nazi in the plane fight sequence and by the sword-wielding giant in the market scene. Sala has to save him from the poison dates. Another of my favorite scenes in the ship captain's cabin with Marion shows him injured, tired, and delightfully vulnerable. And the best single line in the film, I don't know, I'm making this up as I go, shows that he doesn't have a plan. He's just doing the best he can. As Adam said, nothing is wasted. All these moments reinforce multiple aspects of the Indy character, both in isolation and in the context of this particular adventure, his relationship with Marion, his life's pursuits, his friendships, and so on. For me, this added everyman quality to Indiana Jones is one large reason, amongst many, why Raiders of the Lost Ark is beloved as it is. And I really wanted to feature that email because that's something we did only glance at a little bit when I was mentioning why I think Indiana Jones is the best action hero, or my favorite action hero, right up there anyway with Han Solo, another Harrison Ford character, is that everyman quality does come through. I noticed it in particular, it was in my notes, the scene in the cabin where he acts like a child. He acts like a little boy with his mommy kissing his boo-boos when he says, right here is where I'm not hurt. And she kisses him on his eyelid or whatever, and his elbow, and those scenes. That's a very funny sequence. And then, of course, also punctuated by him getting hit in the chin with the mirror and screeching. So there are those moments where you see how vulnerable he is as a character. And that's what makes him so much more engaging as a hero, that he is someone you feel like is superhuman a little bit, but not like a Schwarzenegger or a Stallone or even a Bruce Willis. This is someone we can relate to.
Yeah, I think those moments work, and I especially like the one with the eyelids and the flirtatiousness, how he's thrown off by it, he's flustered by it, he doesn't go and embrace it right away like you might expect. But I also wonder if it isn't something to do with Spielberg's squeamishness with sex. He's not known as a director who really does all that much with sex, and we see a little bit of that here where it's kind of cast aside very quickly.
Maybe he should take some cues from Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes, apparently.
They could collaborate on a film together. That would be fun. Let's close with this one from Larry in San Francisco.
You can tell Michael Phillips to take the stick out of his posterior. He puts Jurassic Park ahead of Raiders. Jurassic Park is full of the sentimental family values crap that constantly drags Spielberg films down. He complains that Raiders is just a thrill ride. Well, sorry that all movies can't be downers about people sitting around moping for 2 hours.
I have to jump in here because, Larry, really, your email's really fun, and I love the beginning to it. And, hey, you could take Michael to task, but that line of reasoning, you know that's not what Michael is arguing for. You know that he can enjoy movies as entertainment as well, just because he doesn't like Raiders.
He does like Anatolia, and that's like 3 hours of people moping.
We all love Anatolia.
That's true. We like it, too. Larry continues, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark when I was 12. I can still pop it into a DVD player and enjoy it as much as ever. I saw it on the big screen for the 25th anniversary edition, but refused to pay IMAX prices to see it again. Indiana Jones is a flippin' icon. His hat is famous. His bullwhip is iconic. It's still Harrison Ford's most memorable creation. I often wonder what happened to the roguish and charming man of those films, since replaced by a dour old curmudgeon who yells his lines. Anyway, Raiders is right there with Spielberg's best. Guess what? I can't be bothered to watch Jaws. I don't care. And I put The Lost World over the crap that is Jurassic Park. I hate Sam Neill.
I love that
he's spraying rage everywhere.
I hate Sam Neill. I'm serious about this. I want to start a spinoff podcast, Grumpy Man Reviews, Larry from San Francisco. Just spew venom like that 15 minutes or so. Just go off on the films you hate. I think that could be very popular. We have so much more feedback to get to, but we're going to stop there for now. Maybe we'll share some more in future bonus content. As always, we appreciate all the great responses we get. You can email us anytime, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Come to me, son of Jor-El. Kneel before our favorite charismatic movie leaders. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Thank you time here on Film Spotting, and we always like to start with a thank you to our partner Jeff Goldsmith for promoting Film Spotting on his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, where he features great interviews with screenwriters, actors, and sometimes directors. You can find that show just by doing a search in iTunes. You can also get Backstory, Jeff's new iPad app. Just look for that in iTunes as well. A couple quick notes before we get to our donations. Josh, I did want to mention our featured artist this week. It's Ben Folds 5. I'm sure a lot of people recognize the sound of Ben Folds 5. And we got a note on Twitter from Sam Emblem. He's at Yep747, who said, featured music next week, your favorite bands with charismatic frontmen / front women. I thought that was a good idea.
Perfect.
We actually had someone else planned, but we bumped them a week and decided let's feature the charismatic Ben Folds and the Ben Folds 5 this week with their new album. I also wanted to include them because the new album is titled The Sound of the Life of the Mind.
Is
which I can
really?
Only assume must be some kind of reference to Barton Fink.
Yeah, it's got to be.
And I'll show you The Life of the Mind. So a film reference, I think anyway, or I want to believe it, in that new album title. So again, that's the Ben Folds 5. You can learn more at benfolds.com. Also have a couple other plugs that came in from listeners. We've made a habit over the past few years of promoting this great event. Details come from Leonard Bushell, who says, still loving your show 7 years later. I appreciate the support you've shown the Real Recovery Film Festival in the past, and I was hoping you could give us another plug as we are having our first New York City Real Recovery Film Festival at the legendary Quad Cinema in the Village starting September 28th through October 4th. And the Real Recovery Film Fest is a group that holds this event to try and support writers and artists who are struggling to overcome addiction. Leonard notes that they still have their LA festival starting October 25th, and we've also added Vancouver, BC, and Fort Lauderdale. So we think this is a great cause. As I said, we've plugged this event the past few years here on Film Spotting, and we've only focused on the LA one, but now they've expanded it. We hope many of our listeners out there will try to take part and support this program. We'll give you a link in the show notes to learn more about the Real Recovery Film Festival. And Leonard says, as a faithful listener, may I suggest a top five of drug and alcohol films? After all, isn't Film Spotting partially named after one of the best drug movies of all time?
True.
It is true.
That would be kind of a depressing top five.
It could be.
It might involve having to sit through Requiem for a Dream again.
Oh, again. A movie I love, but I'm not sure I'm still ready to watch that again. It's a good idea. One we'll definitely file away. I'm actually kind of shocked we haven't done it yet. We also want to plug another event that comes in from listener Tim Evans.
When I'm not reviewing films for Cine Outsider, I'm hosting Double Bill Cinema and Movie Marathons. You can find it at DB Cine Club on Twitter, and we'll also link to it in the show notes. He says, for your UK listeners, I'd appreciate a plug for what I believe is the first Vera Farmiga Film Festival on October 6th. There will be pint breaks at the pub over the road between films as well. Great films and good pub chat with good people. Would love to see some listeners and fellow Vera fanatics there.
And we have the lineup of the movies they're planning on watching. Nothing But the Truth, Never Forever, Higher Ground, Goats, and Joshua are the five movies they're going to screen. I've seen all of those movies, Josh, except Goats.
And I've only seen Higher Ground, so I might have to head over there.
You may have to go to the UK and take part. And I'm kind of mixed on most of those films. I do really like Higher Ground. It's one we talked about in a little bit of detail here on the show. Never Forever is a movie I'm really glad to see on this list. It's a movie I saw at Sundance. Otherwise, it didn't get any kind of notoriety, didn't get any attention.
Never heard of it.
And it's an interesting movie. If I'm remembering it right, she's married to, I believe, a Chinese-American man. And they're struggling to get pregnant, and it's really wearing on their marriage. And she comes up with a plan to get pregnant by another man, just sex, just to get pregnant without her husband knowing, to try to fulfill this quest to have a baby. And as you can imagine, things get a little bit complicated.
It sounds like it could be a bad romantic comedy, but knowing Vera Farmiga is in
it,
it's not going that direction.
Far from a romantic comedy, but a very good film. So hopefully some people will get a chance to see it, and we hope you'll take part in Tim's Movie Club. Again, we will put a link to more information in the show notes. With that, let's get to our donations. And Josh, we had a pretty good week. A lot of very generous people sent some of their hard-earned dollars our way. We start with a new $10 a month donation, $10 a month from Claude Jackson in Phoenix, Arizona.
I just discovered your podcast this past week and have already listened to 5 episodes. Looking forward to listening to much more great movie discussion, and I'm happy to donate $10 a month. Money well spent. Wow, that happened right away.
That happened quick. I think he's in the Cinecrack phase.
Yeah,
he's
apparently
in the phase where the addiction is just, it's just starting to take hold. He's trying to get as much as he can. We want to thank all of our monthly donors, $10, $5, and $2. We really appreciate the support. We have two new Buck a Show donors. This is $1 for every week of the year. We start with Nick in Sanssouci, New South Wales, Australia. Candace is here in the room with us, our associate producer. Did I say that correctly, Candace? Just nod your head. Or shake your head, no, I did not. Either way, Sanssouci, New South Wales, Australia. Also, Vanessa in New York City.
I've been a Film Spotting listener for just over a year. I discovered the podcast by accident while doing a Google search on Manic Pixie Dream Girls, which led me to episode number 326. And I found that there are other people out there who enjoy random top five lists as much as me. My sister and I are now both loyal followers and regularly text each other top five challenges. I really enjoyed your most recent Sacred Cow episode. It was the perfect intro for revisiting Raiders. Very much looking forward to your upcoming marathons. Although, I have to warn you, if Josh is mean to the Marx Brothers, I may have to take them away from him. Here's to another 52 weeks of fantastic shows.
Are you duly warned?
I'm not setting out to be mean to the Marx Brothers. I'm hoping to be convinced of the Marx Brothers.
Well, it's been great getting emails from Vanessa and her sister Samantha. As she said, they are both devoted Film Spotting listeners now, so we thank them for that support. And unfortunately, we got this donation, or I got to this donation a little bit too late. Vanessa wanted us to plug an event where they were showing Raiders of the Lost Ark at the Stamford, Connecticut Avon Theater, but it was September 17th. I apologize, Vanessa, that we missed it. New Silver Club donation. This comes from Tony in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And this is what I love about Film Spotting listeners. They win a prize. They win Massacre Theater. And then apparently they feel guilty, so they donate money to the show.
And it's all part of the master plan.
That's what Tony did.
Without your show, I wouldn't have seen Take Shelter, my personal Film Spotting discovery. And thanks for having Jeff Nichols on the Best Films podcast. I became an even bigger fan of Mr. Nichols since he provided a less, shall we say, stuffy list than other lists from that episode.
I don't think we shall say that.
Now, if you will excuse me, I have to drive off in my Oldsmobile Buick and get a Bloody Mary, a steak sandwich, and a steak sandwich.
I love the Fletch references there, Tony, even if you did just call us stuffy and pretentious. And I had to get another mention of Take Shelter in there. I actually get 50 cents every time I mention Take Shelter here on the show. So I'm slowly becoming a rich man. Our final donation, Keith in Fordyce, Arkansas.
I hate that it's been so long since I've donated. Film spotting is the one and only thing that has kept my workouts fun. Adam, both you and Josh perfectly complement each other, and I love when Michael Phillips stops by. I adore film spotting, and it's a true treat of my week.
Very sweet of you, Keith. Thank you so much for the kind words. Thanks to everybody for donating to the show this past week. You really do keep us doing what we're doing.
Hi, this is Danny Boyle, director of Sunshine and Trainspotting, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Koufax. Koufax kicks. He delivers. It's up the middle. It's a base hit. Richardson is rounding first. He's going for second. The ball's in the deep right center. Davison over in the corner. Cut the ball off. Here comes the throw. Richardson rounding first. He goes into second. He's tied. He's in there. He's safe. It's a double. He's in there, Martin. You look at Richardson. He's on second base. Koufax is in big trouble. Big trouble, baby. All right. Here's Kress as the next batter. Kress looks in. Koufax. Koufax gets a sign from Roseboro. He kicks once. He pumps. He fires. It's a strike. Koufax's curveball is snapping off like a firecracker. All right. Here he comes for the next pitch. Kress swings. It's a long fly ball to deep left center.
Listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's R.P. McMurphy, of course, played by Jack Nicholson from the Milos Forman film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I think that R.P. McMurphy would be an ideal candidate for this week's Film Spotting Top 5, Charismatic Leaders. Kind of gives you a sense of where we're going with this list. Not necessarily characters who would strike you immediately to be leaders, characters who are generals or holding some kind of political office, but someone like R.P. McMurphy, who just through his sheer force of personality is able to rouse his troops in that institution and get them behind him. So he's someone we would definitely consider if it wasn't for the fact that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is in the Film Spotting pantheon, along with a movie we played a clip from earlier in the show, Cool Hand Luke. Luke Jackson, another prime candidate, both misfits too. So it's an interesting way to maybe come at this top five, people who rebel against authority and get other people to follow him. But as we said, in the pantheon of some of our favorite films, not eligible for this list. Josh, how did you form your list of charismatic leaders?
I think the phrase you used, force of personality, is what guided me, really. It's someone who's influential and able to convince a group of followers to follow them, even if it might be against the group's better judgment,
okay,
or even might be in their best interest. So just their pure force of their personality drags people along.
Well, I really hope that listening to this top five is a lot more fun than it was for me to put together.
Okay.
I hated this list. I found it so annoying to try to define what I thought a charismatic leader was, other than R.P. McMurphy and Cool Hand Luke, because it's so abstract. It seems to me that you have charismatic and you have leaders. And so you have to define what you think a leader is. You also have to define what you think charisma is. And both of those things are hard to sort of wrap your head around. So I really struggled with it, but I'm with you that it's someone who gets a group to follow them. There's a certain seductiveness. There's a certain charm to them. I also did consider whether or not they took a group of people and make them better individually and collectively. So that was something I kept in mind, though didn't necessarily abide by. I do need to put out the disclaimer that in May of 2009 here on the show, we reviewed a thoroughly mediocre film called Terminator Salvation and did our top five screen leaders. And my top five at that time were Coach Norman Dale from Hoosiers, Major Reisman from The Dirty Dozen, Harvey Milk from the movie Milk and The Times of Harvey Milk, Henry V from Branagh's adaptation of Henry V, and Colonel Dax from Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory. So four of those five choices, obviously kind of conventional movie leaders you would think of, soldiers or
leaders
politicians.
Leaders by position.
Leaders by position.
Yeah.
Harvey Milk is the only one. He became a councilman, yes, but he got people to follow him through his personality, through his charisma and intelligence. And he would be the only one from that list that would probably transfer over to this new top five list where charisma really is something that matters. And it is a case where their personality as opposed to their status, is what makes them leaders. So I tried to go with people who weren't in a clear position of authority and yet somehow emerged as the leader of this group. So I think we're kind of on the same page?
I think we are, but I think you put a lot more work into
way
it
more,
than I did.
Way more work. Man, this was a struggle.
You didn't overthink
me.
This at all, did you?
Oh, this was a struggle. What's your number five?
Right. You mentioned seductiveness, and I think that applies to my number five, though it's a little bit of a fading seductiveness in the film. This is Don Fabrizio Cabrera, the Prince of Salina. In other words, Burt Lancaster in The Leopard. Luchino Visconti's 1963 film is one of these magnificently opulent three-hour dramas. It's an ode to the fading aristocracy of 1860s Italy. Doesn't sound like Lancaster, does it? And as a matter of fact, he was the third choice, I believe, of who Visconti wanted in the role, kind of forced upon Visconti by the studio. But it did work. If you see the film, you may never believe that it will work, but when you watch it, it really does. As this middle-aged aristocrat who's trying to preserve his family's privileged life, Lancaster turns his masculinity, which we think of as kind of hulking all out there in your face, he turns it inward here, and he uses things like tact and decorum, and he just has this aura about him that makes him the most persuasive person in the room, the most regal person in the room. So he has command. And even though he is this patriarch, and he's the master to the Sicilians who live on his land, the film is really a portrait of how this is fading away from him. And it's best captured in the iconic ballroom sequence that makes up a good chunk of the final third of the film. The prince is dancing there, but he's growing weary, and he kind of fades into the background as the dancing goes on while the young Sicilians come into the foreground and take over, just echoing how this is a powerful, charismatic leader, but it's the waning days of his charisma. So the movie is really more about the dying of charisma than a celebration of it.
Wow. That sounds really fascinating. It's a shame pick for me, Josh. It's a movie I've always meant to catch up with, but haven't seen it. Have seen some other Visconti, but The Leopard is one I have not seen. My number five pick is a movie I'm guessing more listeners have probably seen than The Leopard. And this is one for me that I went back and forth on again and again. And I know I'm going to get some grief for it, but here goes anyway. It occurred to me that one way to come at this list was just to think about who the most charismatic actors and actresses are and then think about the roles they played and whether or not they did manage to portray any leaders. And when you do it that way, it's hard not to include a Robin Williams role. And that's why my number five is John Keating from Dead Poets Society. I almost left him off because he's a teacher, so you could argue he is a kind of authority figure. But thinking about it some more, just because you're in a position of power doesn't mean you're actually going to get people to follow you. And in his case, the only real authority he has is to make sure that his students are showing up for class, they're paying attention, they're doing their homework. What he does, what he leads them to do, what he inspires them to do, is to be more open, curious, interesting people, to view the world and their places in it in a completely new way. And he does it through what you would expect from Robin Williams, his sheer manic energy, his passion, his humor, and also genuinely being interested in their development more than his own ego.
I'd like you to step forward over here and peruse some of the faces from the past. You've walked past them many times, but I don't think you've really looked at them. They're not that different from you, are they?
Same haircuts, full of hormones, just like you. Invincible, just like you feel. The world is their oyster. They believe they're destined for great things, just like many of you. Their eyes are full of hope, just like you. Did they wait until it was too late to make from their lives even one iota of what they were capable? Because you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. Boys are now fertilizing daffodils. But if you listen real close, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. Go on, lean in. Listen. You hear it? Carpe. Carpe diem. Seize the day, boys. Make your lives extraordinary.
I know this movie seems at this point to not be very cool. Back when we did our top five screen teachers on the show, we got emails begging us not to include any of the so-called inspirational teachers like Dangerous Minds and Dead Poets Society. I don't know how this movie holds up. I saw it on video when I was in high school, not too long after it came out. But as a teenager who was coming to terms with the fact that my favorite thing to do academically was read poetry and read books and think about what they were telling me about the world and myself, this movie had a big impact on me. So I'm sticking with it. I'm going with John Keating.
I think that works because it's the rare teacher who can actually get the students to follow. You know, they're, like you said, they are in a position of authority, but that's a completely different thing than having the charisma to get them to follow. So yeah, that works. Let's stick in high school for my number four, which is Matthew Broderick as Ferris Bueller in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Did you ever play that game where you wonder, what did Ferris grow up to be? I know I've talked to people about this, and the answers come down to things like a politician, sports agent,
he totally
maybe,
sold out.
I was just going to say, some sort of salesman. But
not
these
that
are
that's
all
selling
people,
out to our insurance people who are listening.
Nice going there. Uh-huh. These are all people who rely on charisma, who use charisma for their job. And that's pretty much what Ferris exudes throughout the movie. Whether he's convincing Cameron to take out his father's Ferrari, whether he's convincing the maitre d' to get the best seat in the restaurant, this is how Ferris works. Even though he's not at school, we see glimpses from the school and we get the impression that he holds the entire student body in the palm of his hand. There's the Save Ferris campaign when rumors of his illness become exaggerated. I think that he's an enduring figure in film because he's sort of this benevolent dictator of the high school. I mean, high schools can be dictatorships, but Ferris is a benevolent one. Under his rule, high school appears to be clique-free, and it's sort of like everyone's united against adult authority.
I don't trust this kid any further than I can throw him.
Well, with your bad knee, Ed, you shouldn't throw anybody. It's true.
What is so dangerous about a character like Ferris Bueller is he gives good kids bad ideas.
Uh-huh.
Last thing I need at this point in my career is 1,500 Ferris Bueller disciples running around these halls. He jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern this student body.
Well, makes you look like an ass is what he does, Ed.
Thank you, Grace. I think you're wrong.
Oh, well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads. They all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
Well, of course you know this because we talked about it over email. Ferris Bueller was one of my test cases for what is a charismatic leader.
He didn't pass
Ferris
your test?
Me, he didn't pass because Ferris Bueller, for me, is a prime example of someone who should be the number one choice on a list of just top five charismatic characters. But is he really a leader? Because for me, we only see him in the film lead Cameron and Sloan. That's not a big enough group for me. Yes, the school seems united behind him, but we don't actually ever see him lead them. So that was a deal breaker for me, Josh.
Adam, Ferris led a parade.
He did lead a parade. I can't argue with that. Can't argue with that. Well, hopefully you can't argue with my number four choice, and it does nicely follow the charismatic actors theme I set up with Robin Williams, where you think about some of our most charismatic actors, look at their roles. Tripper, Dr. Peter Venkman. How about John Winger, portrayed by Bill Murray from Stripes, a movie that came up on Michael Phillips' top five films of 1981. I think it was his number five. For that reason alone, I tried to overlook it, and I just couldn't. I kept coming back to John Winger, the taxi cab driver who joins the army trying to change his life. And he's got this band of misfits in his platoon. Their sergeant gets hurt. They need someone to step up. They've got just a few hours to prepare for graduation. And Winger does what you need a leader to do, inspire them to greatness.
Now, we don't have to worry about whether or not we've practiced. We don't have to worry about whether Captain Stillman wants to have us hung. All we have to do is to be the great American fighting soldier that is inside each one of us. Now do what I do and say what I say and make me proud. Fall in?
Yeah! It's a great speech, surpassed by then the performance that we see at the graduation. Do what I do, say what I say. These are people who are completely lost. He's saying, rely on me, I'll carry you through. And it works. That's the fact, Jack. John Winger, my number four.
Comedy, charisma, comedy. Yeah,
there you
definitely.
Go.
That applies. My number three isn't a person at all. It's Lotso Huggin Bear. voiced by Ned Beatty in Toy Story 3.
Not a benevolent leader.
No, this is where we're going off track and turning towards the villains. I do have to credit Melissa Taminga of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. She's on Twitter at One April Day. This was her suggestion, and I jumped on it as soon as I saw it. I just absolutely loved it. He employs that cuddly charisma as one of his methods of manipulation. I think he also smells like strawberry, or there's something else he uses that's kind of sweet and cuddly to win you over. But really, this bear is a cult leader. That's what he's creating in Toy Story 3. He gets the toys at Sunnyside Daycare to trust and follow him. Until then, he sacrifices the ones who aren't in his inner circle to those rambunctious, destructive toddlers. Now, of course, because this is a Pixar film, Lotso is also a richly developed character. We get his backstory where we learn he was abandoned by his first owner. He goes on this long journey to find her, only to discover she's found another Lotso hugging bear. This just crushes him, and as a result, he creates this cult of self-disgust, really, where he pretends to offer toys a safe haven, but he really finds them despicable and disposable. Beatty's drawl is so good for this character, and it's another example of Pixar's perfect voice casting, where they don't worry about the star power, but they go with the character first and then find the right person for it. So Lotso's this mesmerizing, terrifying figure. I think he's one of animation's classic villains.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five charismatic movie leaders, tying in with our discussion of The Master this week. And Josh, I can't really argue with your pick of Lotso. I think you articulated it very well. I'm just in shock that you didn't go with my number three from the Toy Story saga.
Are you going to say Woody?
How do you overlook Sheriff Woody, voiced by Tom Hanks, another actor who fits into my scheme here with Robin Williams and Bill Murray on any top five list of our most charismatic actors, certainly our most charismatic comedic actors? Woody's affable. He's got a great sense of humor. He's smart. Maybe most importantly, though, he genuinely cares about every single toy under his command. And when something goes wrong, he's the one who comes up with a plan and gets them out of it again and again in all three of the films. He runs the show. He's highly organized. He gets people to buy into their roles. I think back, the scene that stands out for me in particular with Woody is the second scene of the trilogy, of the first film, where he's instructing everyone to get their moving buddies.
Oh, thanks, Mike. Okay. Oh, whoa. Step back. Hello? Check. That better? Great. Everybody hear me? Up on the shelf? Can you hear me? Great. Okay. First item today. Has everyone picked a moving buddy?
What? Moving buddy? You can't be serious.
Well, I didn't know we were supposed to have one already.
We have to hold hands.
Oh, yeah. You guys think this is a big joke. We've only got 1 week left before the move. I don't want any toys left behind. A moving buddy. If you don't have one, get one.
So again, completely in control, everybody buying into what he's doing. And in that film, when another alpha male comes along, another leader comes along and tries to take charge, this being Buzz Lightyear, they find a way to coexist, but Woody's still the boss. Buzz always ultimately defers to Woody. They look to Woody to lead them, not Buzz Lightyear. That's the sign of a great leader.
I like Woody. I don't want to go down as anti-Woody, but the guy's got no charisma. He's
impossible.
Affable.
Affable.
He's
that's affable. Charisma.
He's caring. That does not equal charisma. He's just a nice guy. I'd want him in charge too, but he's not charismatic.
I disagree. I think that same kind of manic energy that you get from Robin Williams and Bill Murray comes through in just about every Tom Hanks performance, at least the comedic ones. And this is one of them.
He's funny too. Yeah.
He is funny. Yeah. He's very funny.
Woody's nice.
All right. Your number two.
My number two is Julia Roberts as Erin Brockovich. This Steven Soderbergh film gave star vehicles a good name. I am often skeptical of star vehicles, but I think it works here because it uses the star's attributes to appropriately serve the story. Again, it's sort of where character comes first, and then the star, the right star, is made to fit that character. So when you think of Julia Roberts, especially during this era, you think of the casual glamour she had, this genial sense of humor, and, you know, she's talented as an actress, too. You can't overlook that. It all came together to capture the forceful charisma of the real-life Erin Brockovich, this single mom who led a legal battle against a polluting corporation. Now, you have to remember all the people that Brockovich had to convince, really, to pull this off.
That's a good point.
It's not a very promising crusade, so there aren't many people who are going to want to be behind her, and she has to convince her boss, actually, the lawyer played by Albert Finney, to even let her pursue the case. And then the heart of the film is really with her talks with the residents of this town, who themselves are a little scared because the corporation has tried to convince them that nothing's wrong here. And she has to get them on board as well for this lawsuit. And she eventually does.
And say here how much this whole thing's going to cost us.
My fee's 40% of whatever you get awarded.
Boy, do I know how you feel. The first time I heard that number, whew, I said, you've got to be kidding me. 40 goddamn percent?
Aaron,
I'm the one that's injured, and this joker sits at a desk all day, and he wants to walk away with almost half my reward.
Aaron, can I?
But then I asked him what he makes if I don't get anything.
Then I don't get anything either.
Plus, he's out all the costs. So I realized he's taking a chance, too.
She's brash here. She's charming. She's also relentless. Brockovich had enough charisma that it led Roberts to her Academy Award. I think it was well-deserved.
Yeah, I guess some people might find her vulgar instead of charming, actually. And in the film, some of them do. But I see where you're going. And I guess this is as good a time as any to note that one of the reasons I found my list so annoying to put together is I could not find a female character that fit into my scheme. And I did completely overlook Erin Brockovich. It's one I would consider. I'm a fan of that film. And certainly there are other activist female roles that make sense. Norma Rae,
right.
And there are a lot of other characters like that where a woman leads a crusade against something, but either I haven't seen them or they're just not films that really stand out for me. So I considered a couple that we'll get to in the honorable mentions, but I couldn't find a woman that really fit for my list. So I'm hoping that listeners will write in and tell me all the great charismatic female leaders out there that I overlooked. My number two, I'm finally going to break with my string here of comedic actors, people who I think definitely occur to you right away as charming, and go with someone who has a completely different kind of charisma. And I have to thank our producer, Sam Van Halgren, for reminding me of this guy so I could include him this high on my list. It's Tom Donovan, played by John Wayne in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. He doesn't have, as I said, that charisma in the Bill Murray sense, but there is an appeal and a magnetic presence as both a performer and a character. And in particular, he worked for me, Josh, because of that notion of a guy who isn't designated by anyone as a leader. He just emerges to be a leader. He's just a local rancher. He doesn't have a badge, or he's not a soldier in command like other John Wayne roles, but he stands up for himself. He stands up against injustice. He comes prepared for a fight. There's a very memorable scene where it's three against one, and it seems like Lee Marvin has him, but he's got his trusty friend Pompey ready. And at the end of the film, I think most notably here for my list, people follow his lead, and they elect Jimmy Stewart's character mainly because of Tom Donovan's recommendation and his urging. So I think that's important, but also the best aspect of a leader comes through with Tom Donovan, which is he's willing to sacrifice for the greater good. He allows someone else to get the recognition, to get all the glory for something he did, because he recognizes that ultimately it's the right thing to do for the people he cares about and for his town. So Tom Donovan's my number two.
That's my stake, Valance.
You heard him, dude. Pick it up.
No. Pilgrim, hold it. I said you, Valance. You pick it up.
All right, number one, I'm going to go with Ian McKellen as Gandalf in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You would follow him anywhere, wouldn't you?
No.
That's... You would not. You'd go the other way. You'd just say, forget it, Gandalf. You don't know what you're talking about.
I'm not following an elderly man in a robe with a staff. No.
Wow. You really do have a hobbit problem. In this series, Frodo follows him through orcs, through trolls, through a Balrog. See, I can talk geek. I can talk geek too, Adam. McKellen is just one example of why this fantasy series works so well and is really a classic of the genre, because you have actors giving performances at this Shakespearean level, lending it a credibility. That's what McKellen does here as Gandalf. And he has this sneaky sort of leadership style that his charisma is definitely a part of. He doesn't just announce what his band of hobbits and dwarves and elves should do, and they go do it. He doesn't always just use his power, of which he has a lot. He's not just an old man in a robe. He does it sometimes, but more often than not,
so says you,
more often than not, he'll convince those following him what they can do, what small powers they have, what personality aspects they have that will serve the larger journey, the greater journey that they're all on. And this echoes one of the main themes of the Lord of the Rings saga, which is that accomplishment comes, great things can be done through unexpected heroes, all led by Gandalf, Adam. Gandalf.
Okay, you're number one. I'm going to right the ship now with my number one and close with a man who convinces a bunch of men that it's a good idea to get together in a basement every week and beat the crap out of each other. And if that's not charisma, I don't know what is. I'm speaking of Tyler Durden, played by Brad Pitt in the David Fincher movie Fight Club. He is a man who has a way with words. He's certainly bluntly honest, and there's no hesitation about Tyler Durden whatsoever. He is supremely confident, and I think that confidence is a trait that comes through with all the great leaders we've mentioned on our list. I'm actually going to read a quote from him now, Josh. Let's make sure that Sam and Joe, our producers, are ready with the bleep button. All the ways you wish you could be, that's me. I look like you want to look. I f*** like you want to f***. I am smart, capable, and most importantly, I am free in all the ways that you are not. That's charisma, and he certainly gets a lot of people to follow him into some pretty dangerous and surprising territory. There's also a great speech he gives in Fight Club that cemented it for me as my number one pick because it goes back to the master.
Man, I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. God damn it, an entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables. Slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes. Working jobs we hate so we can buy we don't need. We're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war. No great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives.
Listening to Tyler Durden there, could that not be a speech that Lancaster Dodd in The Master might give to Freddie Quell, this notion of having no purpose or place, disillusioned by the American dream, and very unhappy about it, filled with rage? I'm telling you now, Josh, Freddie Quell would be at every Fight Club every week. He would never miss it, and I think he'd be a star. So it all came back around to the master for me. Had to go with Tyler Durden.
He'd also lose to Gandalf.
He probably would, actually. Sadly, you're right. What about some honorable mentions, Josh? Who did you have trouble leaving off?
I did have a couple of other women that I thought about. Haley Steinfeld in True Grit. Couldn't quite decide whether she, how much of a leader she was for that band. Almost an accidental leader in a lot of ways.
I think, but yeah.
Julie Andrews in Mary Poppins. She has charisma.
She definitely has charisma.
She's nicer than Woody, even.
Maybe so.
Johnny Knoxville is the leader of the Jackass gang. Thought about him briefly.
I like that.
Yul Brynner in The Magnificent Seven. Mr. Fox is fantastic. Mr. Fox and Kermit in The Muppets.
Well, I'll list off here the seven or eight that I wrestled with the most, and they just did not fit into where I was going, and there's no reason to really parse it. I'll just give them to you. The two women I thought about, Ripley from Aliens, the James Cameron Alien installment, where obviously Sigourney Weaver steps up as the person who ends up leading that group and doesn't really have any authority there whatsoever, but she's just the most able-bodied and smartest person to do it. I also thought about Jane Holly Hunter in Broadcast News. She is the executive producer. She is the boss, but she's leading that news team. And when it comes to energy, if you equate manic energy with charisma, as I seem to want to do, she's full of it there in Broadcast News. Other people, Philippe Petit, the man on a wire star who leads his group of people on the amazing heist, if you will, where they break into the Twin Towers and he pulls off the amazing feat of walking on the wire between the two towers. Joe Kenahan, Chris Cooper's character from Matewan. Joe Gideon from All That Jazz, one of my favorite movies. And Fitzcarraldo is a film I've mentioned too often on the show. But when you talk about someone who really has no authority whatsoever, but convinces people to do crazy things that are against their best interests, really just on the force of his personality, it is Fitzcarraldo, Klaus Kinski in that Werner Herzog film. So those are the ones that were tough for me to leave out, and those are our top five charismatic movie leaders. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Won't Back Down, Hotel Transylvania, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which is a movie I have to admit, other than seeing Ezra Miller, the actor, actually smile in a film for once, that was refreshing. I had no interest in seeing this movie, but I understand it's getting some pretty decent reviews. So.
Ezra Miller from We Need to Talk About Kevin?
We don't actually need to talk about Kevin, and we shouldn't either. Also, Looper, the new Rian Johnson film. That's out in wide release this weekend. In limited release, Pitch Perfect, starring Anna Kendrick, and Head Games. I know it's playing here in Chicago. This is the new documentary about concussions in sports from Steve James, the director of Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters. Next week here on the show, what else? We're going to talk about Looper. We're still trying to decide what our top five is going to be.
We need some suggestions,
yeah,
I think.
Our group on the Film Spotting Forum has thrown out some good ideas. One of them that intrigues me is characters who are portrayed by multiple actors,
right,
as you have in Looper with Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt playing the same guy. So we may go that route, but
we're
open to ideas.
There's something about makeup on there, too.
Yeah, there might have been.
About makeup being employed. So, yeah, we've got a bunch of ideas we're toying with.
Yeah, and if you have any other ideas for us, we'll certainly consider them. Feedback at filmspotting.net. We'll also spend a few minutes previewing the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist, Ben Folds 5, led by the charismatic Ben Folds. Learn more at benfolds.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.